from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live conversation with the author Juliette Whitman, whose new novel is Stalker's Kitchen. I'm going to share a little bit of information now about Juliette, and then we'll get started with our conversation. Juliette Whitman grew up in London and has lived in the United States through much of her adult life. An investigative reporter, theater critic, and writing instructor at the University of Colorado, she taught writing classes on the topic of food for several years. Much of her thinking on the centrality of food to our lives and the way it shapes thought and culture was inspired by her students' personal stories. Juliette Whitman has won journalism awards and published essays and short stories in literary magazines. Her memoir, Breast Cancer Journal, A Century of Petals, won the Colorado Book Award and was named a finalist for the National Book Award. She lives in Boulder, Colorado, with her husband and Airedale, Allie. Stalker's Kitchen concerns a short, loud, and profane chef and restaurant owner, Stalker, who is a passionate sensualist and a bully. Yet despite his manifest flaws, brilliantly clean and delectable flavors emerge from his greasy restaurant kitchen. His unassailable self-confidence falters when he falls in love with Angela, a half-Vietnamese woman as strong-willed as himself. The stories of many characters intertwine in this book. Motherly waitress Crystal, Megan, an insecure young actor trying to find her footing in New York, pastries chef John, whose finicky, meticulous work habits drive Stalker wild, and Keith, John's patient, kindly lover. Stalker's Kitchen tells a story about food, love, and a small hot restaurant kitchen at the heart of one of the world's greatest cities. And now I would like to just welcome Juliette to Write the Book. It's great to have you here. Are you there, Juliette?
I am here, yes.
Wonderful. We're speaking live from WBTV LP 99.3 FM in Burlington, Vermont. Juliette is on the phone with me. It's great to have you here. I wonder if we could start by having you read a short section or two of Stalker's Kitchen.
Well, this is Stalker, who's just met a young woman with whom he's very rapidly falling in love. And afterwards, he's standing alone in his kitchen, making stew.
Wonderful.
Stalker was standing over his ancient black pot at midnight, steam collecting wetly on the tip of his nose as he peered into the depths. The staff had all gone home, and he was alone with the hastily wiped down counters, the sink, the hanging implements and pots and pans, the smell of onion and potato, the rustling of hidden mice, and his thoughts about Angela. He replayed the meal he'd served her and the way she'd eaten it, saw the chipped red polish on her toes, her hands, her mouth, and for a second he thought, for no particular reason, about the cat, that skinny, angular little creature skulking in the alley. It was as if there were a connection between the cat and this girl, this woman made of angles and shadows, who had uttered soft little grunts of pleasure as she ate. With her febrile, vibrating energy, Angela hadn't seemed like an eater, but it turned out she was. The stew he was making was for himself. It would never be served in his restaurant. Putting ingredients together, stirring, inhaling, this was his form of meditation, and the kitchen his natural habitat, the environment he swam through, waking and sleeping, the place where he spent crazed hot days in a maze of sensation, smelling, watching food change color and texture, listening to bubbling liquids and the searing of meats, tasting, though some of his fellow chefs said it was a miracle he could taste anything at all, given the constant smoking. And it was true, his mouth was always full of the flat, bitter sensation of old smoke between the crevices of his teeth and floating above his tongue. But there it was. Somehow his food was stellar, at least according to the critics. Stellar in a quite straightforward and specific way, with every taste distinct upon the palate, a phenomenon you could attribute to the vagaries of the food gods, whom he worshipped without fail, morning and evening, through the feel of the tools in his hands and dough between his fingers. Oh, yes, Stalker did have gods, black looming figures thick with the effluence of centuries of cooking and feeding, the history of eating humanity, from the Neanderthals around their fires, placing food in the midst of the circle and showing their teeth in a gesture that meant, I'm no threat, I will share. This being the characteristic that made us uniquely human, Stalker believed. Not speech, not some misty ephemeral soul, not fidelity or love, but the willingness to share food, from which rose communities and civilizations, myths and stories, and great cities like this one, this city, at the center of the universe and his adopted home. And then, to summarize a little bit, Stalker serves himself a bowl of his stew and sits down, and as he eats, he remembers a childhood memory.
Okay.
They'd pull up at the same time. He's with his parents. They'd pull up at the same time each week in the ancient rattling truck whose back doors were held in place with wire so that his mom had to come round to untwist the strands and let him out. He'd jump out onto the rutted ground, jolting his knees, and barely have time to inhale the freezing air before they were through the door and into the sweat and beef-smelling warmth of skeeters. Jack Cody was behind the counter. Everyone always used both names addressing him. Never Jack, never Mr. Cody, owner and cook. He'd have laughed if you called him chef. Laughter that shook the hard belly under his stained apron and displayed a mouthful of bad teeth. When they were seated at their booth, Violet would come over. A cruel name, he reflected now, for such a big woman. Hey, she'd say, pulling the notepad from her apron pocket, holding her pencil ready above it. What can I do you for? And she'd laugh and sometimes put a damp hand on his hair, while he held very still, willing her to keep it there. Violet. Fat, ugly Violet with her thinning hair and wandering eye, who had worked at Skeeter's since time began, or at least since any memory he had of time beginning. He stared down at a piece of cabbage leaf in his bowl, edges dissolving into dark liquid. Some of the kids said Violet was a witch and cringed away from the plates of food she set in front of them. But it was a perspective he'd never understood. You'll be wanting a cheeseburger, she'd say to him, and he'd nod, noting his parents' carefully neutral faces, aware that they disapproved of his gluttony but were resigned to suffering it this one night a week. He'd pay for it later. For days he'd get pared-down rations, bits and scraps of things, fighting the constant squirm of hunger in his belly, while they reminded him, Violet, the cheeseburger, the fries, you stuffed yourself, remember? He's got an appetite, Violet would say, smiling. Just look at him scarf down the food. More fries, hon? Yes, he'd say. But his parents would smile politely, his mother holding up a hand to cut off discussion. I think he's had enough. They were angry, mean-spirited people, his mother and father, or rather these imposters, who posed as his parents. Without anyone asking, Violet would bring dessert, a huge slab of lemon meringue pie, and set it in front of him, and he'd bend his face close and plunge his fork through the hardened foam of the meringue with its myriad tiny bubbles and into the sliding custard below, getting white and yellow all over his lips and cheeks, eating fast, 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 before his father could say, we didn't order the pie, and Violet respond quickly, it's on the house today. I think he's had enough, that was his mother repeating infuriatingly. There was never enough. Meanwhile, he was thrusting sticky pieces into his mouth and chasing smears of sweetness around the plate with his finger and wishing fat, ugly Violet would place her hand on his head again and hold it there for a long time. And maybe take him home with her at the evening's end.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for reading that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to see that backstory of Stalker's childhood, because it gives you a little bit of an insight into who he is and why he surrounds himself with the people that he does in his own kitchen later in life as an adult. So that's great.
Yes, I always had this fear that after reading the first chapter, people would toss down the book and say, I don't want to know anything about this guy. Because he is kind of beyond the pale.
He's rough. But
yeah, he's rough.
Yeah. So what was your initial idea for Stalker's Kitchen? I am curious. Was it his character or was it something else?
You know, it kind of happened very organically. I was just working, you know how you sometimes work with an exercise to get yourself writing in the morning?
Yes.
I didn't even have a plan to write a novel. I was just, playing. And I had Ursula Le Guin, Steering the Craft, which is a wonderful book of prompts. And she had a prompt that was something like a hot, cluttered environment with a lot of different people in it and a lot going on. And I forget, she probably said, write the whole thing in one sentence, or because that's how she does it.
Yeah.
And I just started writing, and it was about a kitchen, and Stalker was there, and some of the other people who come up later in the book were there, and I was having such a good time because I wasn't trying to be clever, or I wasn't trying to do anything. I was just having fun. And then I returned to it for the next couple of days to play around with it more and more, and the more I played with it, the more I wanted to stay with him because he fascinated me.
Yes, and that's the best, isn't it? When you create a character that then you want to stick with because you want to see what happens, it's kind of funny, isn't it?
Yes, and then I thought, well, I'll write a book that's all Stalker vignettes, like Stalker cooks a lobster. You know, I thought of it scuttling around the floor. I thought of it as funny, like a series of comic vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
Stalker fires a commie, or Stalker falls in love. And I got, oops, Stalker falls in love. I'm going to explore that.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful, it's funny, it may have started out as funny vignettes, but it's not a funny book. It's got funny moments, but it's very serious. There's a lot of incredible depth to it and some really serious themes that are worked out. It's fun that it started that way.
You know, we are who we are, and as much as I love to be really funny and bring people into big belly laughs, I'm not.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope I have some mild sense of irony, but I always end up with, conflict and seriousness and maybe some death. And I think
well, it's real. It's very real.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, are you a foodie? I know that you write some restaurant reviews. Are you a cook as well?
I write theater reviews, actually. I'm obsessed with food. I love to cook. I think my husband came into the kitchen once, and I was just caressing an eggplant. He said, oh, I've caught you. I mean, I just, it's so sensual. I'm not a foodie in the sense that I go chasing down the latest restaurant or the latest trend.
Okay.
I'm interested in food to some extent in the exact same way that Stalker is, which is the way our eating habits shape us, the way eating together shapes cultures. If you ever sit down next to someone on a plane and you think, oh, this guy is going to be so boring, and if you can find a way to ask him what he had for dinner, you know so much about him. I mean, food is always about narrative. It's always about stories. And that has fascinated me, I think, forever. I didn't know it was respectable.
Yeah.
I mean, it was only about 10 years ago that it was sort of respectable to teach a class that focused on food. And then there was this flood of books.
Yeah. I think I just saw something local. I think one of my announcements at the end of the show for local events is about a history of food. But anyway, so the book, Stalker's...
I'm going to cram that into an hour or two, I think.
I know, right? The whole history, everything. Stalker's Kitchen, it is full of wonderful descriptions. And because it is a book about, you know, when it comes right down to it, a lot of it's about food, but it's also about people, and there are wonderful descriptions of settings and moments in time. And there are wonderful descriptions of awful things and beautiful things and ugly things and dull things. And so I wanted to, if you don't mind, I want to just read a description of a pretty generic place. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, it's just a few sentences. Mm-hmm. The motel room felt airless and plastic. On the wall opposite her was a square painting of scarlet poppies with dead, flat, black centers. She heard cars sliding by outside. So that's it. I mean, it's just this incredibly simple little snapshot of a moment in a pretty generic place. But that's all it needs to be, you know, to put us in that room. And actually, because it's a room that many of us have already been in before, we've been in motels like that, you didn't have to work very hard to help us to see it, but you did it just right. So I just wondered if we could talk about writing descriptions to convey what you hope to share with your readers.
Oh, my. That's a very good question.
Do you go someplace and take notes, or are you mostly writing from your head?
I think... you know, when I was in my teens and 20s, I wanted to be an actor, and I trained, and there's this thing called sense memory exercise that people were doing at the time, they probably still are, where you just kind of sit and imagine yourself somewhere, and you're not supposed to think, oh, yes, you're not supposed to classify the emotions you felt, you're supposed to look at the sensory details. What do I see? What do I smell? What do I hear? What do I touch? What do I taste?
Right.
And probably, I don't think it's that conscious now, but I try to put myself in the place where my character is. And of course, I've already tried to put myself into the character. None of these characters are exactly like me. I mean, there isn't a figure in this. Oh, maybe the young actress who's actually...
Right.
You know, they're all imagined, but you tried, if this happened to me, then what? If I were in this room, then what? And in some cases, like, I don't want to give away any plot, but there's a hospital. I mean, we've all, I think, experienced being in a hospital with someone we love very sick.
Right.
And that's fairly generic, too, but that's an acute sense memory, I think,
right,
that you can work with.
Yeah, and, you know, having you mention the senses, you know, I'm looking at what I just read from your book, you know, and the fact that the motel room feels airless and plastic, well, that sort of insinuates something about smell. And, you know, there's the painting, which is visual, and then she hears cars outside. So, I mean, that's right there, three senses in that tiny little snapshot. So that really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I hadn't dissected it like that, but
yeah. Yeah. Now, the book is absolutely chock full of these wonderful contradictions, which I find fascinating. And I think that conflict in fiction is always most interesting. But these contradictions are right down to, like, the line level. So for example, you know, the stalker prepares food, but in a very dirty kitchen, you know, and he's not trying to keep everything pristine. And then Crystal, one of the characters, mentions that the tables in the dining room are elegantly inelegant. But there's also all kinds of contradictions. There's a push and pull of appetites, which I'll ask more about soon. And there's Stalker both being a bully and also someone who wants to protect the vulnerable. And let's see, do you mind if I read another little bit?
No, it is very interesting just hearing your analysis, actually.
Let me see. So this is the character Angela, who's the one, in fact, that Stalker is falling in love with in that earlier part that you were mentioning. Here we go. She's describing some clothing. She says, "Look at this, Sean." He looked, chewing slowly. She said, I love this stuff. She's looking at a magazine. I love this stuff. She said, it's a joke, a cosmic joke. That's what people don't get. They're making fun of us, the designers. It's like this little isolated, completely nutty inward world they live in where everyone's just playing everyone else. Nothing to do with the things you actually put on your back. Nothing to do with rain or warmth or practicality. And, you know, she's talking about how, you know, there's so much contradiction in fashion. And that's just another little example. But the whole book is just full of that. And I wondered if that was on your mind when you wrote.
I think that's probably just the way my mind works. I mean, I'm sure it was on my mind. I don't know if I thought of it consciously in the way you're describing it. I think there's a huge contradiction at the center. And that's the one you mentioned, which is that Stalker is sort of a bad person, and yet he nourishes through his food. I mean, his food is a tremendous act of love and generosity. So I think that's one. But yeah, I think life just always seems to be full of contradictions. When I was in the classroom, I always heard myself saying, "Well, on the one hand, this,
right,
but on the other hand, that." And then I used to get really annoyed when my students, I asked them not to use the phrase, I've looked at both sides of the issue.
Yeah.
I said, you know, there are never two sides. There may be one or there may be 12.
Yeah.
Life isn't binary. Life is very complicated.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's... That relates to what you point out, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a good point that it's not just two things, that there's always so much complication going on, which is what we want to read about. We want to understand multifaceted characters and situations, and that's what draws us in.
And what do we do with, you know, those videos people post on Facebook where someone is standing outside a mosque yelling obscenities and someone comes outside and invites him in and all of a sudden he's somebody else? I mean, what do we do with that?
Right.
People are so complicated, and you say, well, who's the real person, that hate-filled gargoyle standing outside, or the guy who's completely melted by the fact that the imam came out and said, join us, come talk to us?
I mean,
yeah.
My father used to tell a story about somebody who cut him off in traffic and then, you know, flipped him the bird. And he was on his way to work to do a job interview. And sure enough, that's the guy that came for the job interview. And I always sort of wished that he had gone ahead and interviewed him because I thought it would have been more interesting, but he just threw him out. So.
Oh, well, it's very understandable.
Yeah. Julia, your parents fled Czechoslovakia for England.
Yes.
During the Second World War, and you were born soon after. But even though you didn't experience that flight from one country to another, I assume that affected you. And I wondered if growing up with this history, do you think that that contributed to your becoming a writer?
Yes. I think it shaped so much. I was watching the images of Notre Dame today, and all I could think of was St. Paul's Cathedral. That happened before I was born, but we were very familiar with those images.
Mm-hmm.
As I was growing up. So becoming a writer, well, the content of what I write, yes, and maybe some attempt to make shapeless events shapely.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sense of things that don't make much sense.
Right.
It definitely affects my worldview.
Yeah.
And I don't think Stalker is very political at all, but I am. And almost everyone in Stalker is sort of an outsider. I mean, they're not all foreign, except for Angela's mother and John, of course, who's English and Hungarian.
Right, I noticed that.
Which I think I always say to people, those are the two most arrogant cultures in the world, and he's got both of them. But, John very much, I mean, not him himself, but the people I described as his grandparents, I certainly knew, and they were also refugees. And they were from Hungary. His grandparents fled the revolution, that the people I knew fled the Second World War.
Right. Okay. Now, let's see. Your characters have they're very different, but a lot of them have a curiosity about the world that I really found appealing. And one example is Angela's recalling that in her youth she shaved her head when she was a teenager. She did it for personal reasons, and there's a bit of a story around it. But apart from that, she just seemed to want to know what it would feel like and how people would react to her. But the whole book is so full of characters wanting to experience and try and probe, you know, with food and with life. And I wondered if you were almost hoping to instill something passionate in your reader or you know, create a desire to act.
Well, a few people have said it created a desire to eat. but let me think. Well, yeah, I think that wouldn't have been conscious, but I like that idea. I'm very nosy about other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know why they do what they do. And how the things they wear and eat and say and the way they walk represent them.
Right.
So, yeah, I think I'm a very nosy person, and I suppose that's why my characters would be very curious as well. And I think people should be open. People should be open to life. I mean, if you get into a car with a Lyft driver and you don't know anything about him or her 20 minutes later, I think you're kind of a boring person. If you're just going to sit there and, you know, tap your phone or something.
Right.
It's an opportunity to enter a whole new world, a very limited, like a very small stage play, you know.
Right, yes. Although I also wondered if the fact that it starts with Stalker and his kitchen, mm-hmm. and cooking and food and putting different ingredients together and trying different things, if that set off in you a sort of creative journey that was going to lean in that direction. Is that possible?
Yes. That sounds absolutely. I think I had a scene. I might have, you know, you write some exercise scenes and you cross, you know, you throw them away. But
right.
I think I had a scene where it was almost as if the stew itself were, you know, because it was this co-mingling of all these different things.
Uh-huh.
And I think the novel maybe to some extent is as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that works for me.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago that there's a character in the book who's an acting student. Her name is Megan.
Yes.
And I loved, you had a few different scenes that sort of introduce us to her acting class and the students in that class. But the mm-hmm. one scene that I first ran across where you're introducing these students, I loved how the scene sort of demands that we consider who are we going to get to know better. Like you describe, I don't know, maybe four or five people a little bit. And I'm sort of reading going like, who's going to be a character that I will be invested in out of these little, it was really kind of fun. And I'm pleased to say I was right. but do you recall writing this scene? And I wondered if you yourself knew who each character would be to the book as you worked on the scene.
Yes and no. I knew that some of her classmates were sort of window dressing. You know, every acting class, there's a beautiful girl who gets lots of roles that she shouldn't be. She's not that good, but she's so beautiful. I mean, there's always a sort of dynamic in a class like that because everyone is so vulnerable and they're so young. So I absolutely knew that Nabil, you know, that the Palestinian, well, his parents are French and Palestinian, I guess.
Right.
I knew he was important. And I didn't know that the student who was strange and pale but oddly talented, Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know she was, but she, some of these characters, I kind of hate it when authors talk about the characters coming to life and all I have to do is sit back and watch them because, yeah, right. Yeah. It's that easy. That's it. Turn on the lights. But, you know, they do start to tell you who they are. I mean, all I knew about John was that he interviewed with Stalker, and he was tall and skinny and had black hair and red sneakers. And I knew he had a lover, or that I thought his lover would just be someone he picked up at a bar. I didn't know. But the one that surprised me the most, I think, was in the very first paragraph, you have Harold yelling at his mother on the phone.
Right.
I didn't think you'd meet his mother. I had no ideas about her.
Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
I'm
just going to step out for a second and say that we're talking to Juliette Whitman about her book Stalker's Kitchen, and this is WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM. We're streaming online at 993wbtv.org. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word about Write the Book. So the book does explore lots of different various types of appetite, culinary, experimental, sexual, I'll say domestic, because there are scenes where somebody's trying to figure out if he wants to be domesticated.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I mean, this kind of comes back to reflect what we said before about starting with food, that appetite will naturally follow. But were there larger reasons that you wanted to explore appetite?
Well, I think I was a little bit thinking about when Buddhists talk about the hungry ghost, that both Stalker and Angela are so terribly hungry. And I think also, I think there's an artist called Romare Bearden, and one of his pieces is this huge whale with its mouth wide open, and you kind of get the idea it's swallowing the world. So maybe that was there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I have a better answer.
That's fine, and it's also a little bit of a redundant question because we've kind of covered a little bit of that already, but I was thinking of it in terms of appetite. So you obviously love wordplay. You know, there are just some wonderful fun with words, you know, the alliteration and the way that you use words to reflect sound, you know, crackling, simmering, spluttering, shushing, slushy mm-hmm. food sounds. That was really fun.
Yes.
And then you also sort of seem to have your own rules about quotes around dialogue, which I found interesting.
We haven't been doing them in this novel. I don't think that... There's only a quote if someone is actually quoting a quotation.
Oh, okay. Well, it was fun.
Yeah.
I was like, wait a minute. There's a quote there, but there's no quote here. So was that just you didn't want to have quotes at all around your character's dialogue?
It just didn't come out that way.
Mm.
I mean, I would usually, but this time it felt so nice and clean, just... I can see where it could get a little confusing if someone's talking in the middle of a paragraph.
Right.
But mostly I think it was pretty clear.
Yeah. No, I thought so too. I was never confused. It was just,
yeah.
It just came up for me. I was like, oh, well, I wonder why. And then what about the wordplay? I mean, it sounds like you do a lot of exercises. Do you take that down to the line level and try to do a lot with onomatopoeia and things like that?
Probably I have. Now I don't think I'm consciously putting my focus on that. I think it just happens. But I think I was about 14, the most magnificent English teacher in grammar school. And she told us all these things, and she had a beautiful voice. I think she either had been an actor or had wanted to be an actor,
yeah.
And she loved the material she was sharing with us. So she read it to us, absolutely mesmerized me. But then she'd stop and explain. She'd talk about what was it? Something. I think it was Mort D'Arthur. Something about the shining levels of the lake, and she'd explain. The onomatopoeia, she'd explain the alliteration, the shining levels of the lake, and her voice was so lovely. And I think I've been very word conscious. I mean, I probably was when I encountered her, but she brought it into focus. Mm-hmm. And I still sometimes hear her voice when I'm reading a poem.
Right.
So I think it's just very natural to me to be very word conscious and always try and pick the exact right word.
Yeah.
For whatever you're trying to say. I think probably when I was younger, and I think this is something a lot of very young writers do, where they're so self-consciously poetic, it's just annoying. I mean, that's where the focus is. You know what I mean? It's like watching a play and the actor has to do an English accent, and you know that's all he's thinking about. He's thinking, I've got to say can't. And you're saying, no, just relax. Just sound like yourself and say the words. But so I wouldn't want to think I was precious in that way.
Right, right.
But absolutely an obsession with language.
Yeah, okay. Now, did
and
you...
God bless Mrs. Fairs.
Were you in England when you were in school?
Yes.
Curious. Not that doesn't mean, you know, anything in particular. I just was trying to picture her reading to you. I was trying to hear it. Let's see. Did you ever envision any of these chapters as standalone pieces?
I didn't when I was writing them, but I can now. I think I've sent in a couple of them to various short story contests and things like that.
As I was reading, I felt like they could. Some of them could stand alone nicely, I thought. Now you just happened to mention something that leads me nicely into this next question. You said that you like to have just the right word, and I kind of pictured you as somebody who drafts and is allowing yourself to be messy and all over the place and just get everything out on paper and then revises later. But I'm wondering, are you more of a meticulous first drafter?
Oh, you nailed it the first time.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's write like crazy. So you can outwrite the critic in your head that tells you you don't know where you're going, you don't know what you're doing, and just get a lot of words on paper. But I rewrite over and over and over again. You know, I think most writers do. We've all got a little bit of OCD. You know, you put the end in the sentence and you look at it. You take it out, then you reread the whole page and put it back in.
Yeah.
But that's the second stage. If I don't, it's almost like I'm trying to rush past myself.
Okay. Do you revise sort of the next day, or do you wait till you have a full first draft and then revise?
No. I would write a scene... go back and revise it the next day, push a little further in.
Okay.
Maybe at some point I decide, oh, I'm going to write this scene. I know it's somewhere in the middle of the book, but I'm not sure where, and that wouldn't be part of that process. That would be back to splashing stuff on the... I was sort of Jasper Johns, you know, throwing paint at the wall.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Okay. Now, you have a lot of varied writing experience, and I mistakenly said earlier that you write restaurant reviews, but you are a journalist, and you write theater reviews, and you've also written memoir reviews, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how being a journalist has affected your fiction, and also what a couple of your favorite memoirs are.
Oh my. Okay. How it's affected my... I was afraid for a while that, you know, that when you write for a newspaper, you are supposed to write shorter sentences, shorter paragraphs, you know, maybe shorter words, and I was afraid I would wreck myself doing that. But actually, I think especially writing a lot gives you a facility, and facility is good.
Yeah.
And you can choose to write a great long run-on sentence that goes on for half a page, especially if you've been reading Ursula Le Guin's prompts.
Yes.
Because she prompts you like that. Or you can decide you're going to have some stickamithy or whatever. You're going to have some short, choppy stuff. So I think being a journalist can be very, very helpful. I also think you meet and talk to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You talk to immigrants and you talk to prisoners. And I did interview a Vietnamese woman at great length who's had lost her child in the same way that one of the characters in the novel has. I don't want to go. I'm going to tell you some of the plot, and I don't want to do that.
No, don't do that.
Yeah, you meet people and you talk to them. I certainly talk to a lot of chefs.
Okay.
What does it feel like to be you, you know? And I think as a journalist, you have access. You can call them up and say, will you talk to me for an hour? And they will.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. People are very generous at talking about themselves with writers, aren't they? They like sharing their stories. I think it's sad when people say they're too intimidated to call and ask somebody something.
They do. They want to tell their stories,
yeah.
Just as you said.
Now, I was going to ask you what you've read lately that you might recommend. So it could be memoirs, or it doesn't have to be. But do you have any book suggestions for listeners who are readers, which most of them are?
Well, I just ordered The Parisian, which I can't recommend because it just came into my Kindle yesterday. And I've been reading Andrew Bacevich about the end of the American century because I'm really interested in politics.
Okay.
And I love everything, almost everything of Zadie Smith. She writes a lot about the part of London where I grew up, actually, which is a place where immigrants come to.
Yes.
In my day from Eastern Europe and in her day from all over the world.
Yes.
And memoirs. I like Oliver Sacks.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's Uncle Tungsten. And the one time Tony Ute, who's a wonderful historian, actually was gracious enough to give us a memoir or an autobiography. I forget what it was called, but I think it's when I'm kind of in love with a writer for the way they look at the world, I want to know more about their lives.
Okay.
So that would be Oliver Sacks. I think of him as this wonderful father figure or uncle, or I was brokenhearted when he died. I think everyone should read him.
Yeah, he has so much to say to people in general and to writers and creative people. And
and you want to talk about curiosity. My God, and a whale going through life with its mouth just absorbing information.
Yes.
That was Oliver Sacks.
Yes. Now, you and I share a favorite author from childhood, which I saw on your website, which is Enid Blyton.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm not from England, but we went on a trip there when I turned 9 in England, and we were on a trip, and I started reading Enid Blyton. I read the 5 series. I just loved everything she wrote, and I wondered if we could talk about that. What did you love about Enid Blyton?
Oh, it was so long ago, but, I mean, she just told a great story.
She did.
And I do think her characters were very vivid, and the dialogue was very vivid, and I was probably about the same age you were.
Yeah.
And I just remember weird little scenes like some children going out to steal strawberry runners or something. I don't know.
There were always a lot of cheese sandwiches and picnics in castles and things like that.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I shall have to revisit her now.
Yeah. So let me ask you, Juliet, what are you working on now? Are you writing any new fiction or anything?
Yes. Just the tiniest embryo of a beginning. Again, you know, I mean, you're going to think I'm so dependent on Ursula Le Guin, but it was another prompt.
Well, she's working for you.
Yeah. Speaking of someone I do enjoy reading, the prompt was something like, there's an old woman doing something or other, and I thought, yeah, I can do that. And then she's remembering a scene from when she's young, and Le Guin's test was sort of to go back and forth in time, and you could change to present tense, to past tense, you could make the past the present, you know, and so on.
Right.
And you could also change person, like it could be first person, it could be second, or probably not second, but third. And I just sat down and started writing. That was an easy one because I don't usually, as I said earlier, I don't usually put myself in them.
Okay.
But this was very autobiographical, and as I was writing, I was remembering so much about Willesden Green, where I grew up, and London, which was a very different London from the one people would be visiting now, and then for the memory, I had a good friend in grammar school who was from a very rough neighborhood in Liverpool. She's a working class girl, and I mean, we weren't wealthy, but we were. It was a very different culture that she grew up in, very tough, and so she was a miracle to me. I was so interested and impressed with her life.
Right.
And so she became the memory, but in the novel, because of course it's fiction and you get to make things up. So it's about these two friends and this old woman looking back on the friendship, but the girl from Liverpool is quite a wicked little spirit, which my friend wasn't. And so then there's some plot.
Oh, fun.
And you'll be surprised to hear there's a death.
Oh, yeah, well. There have to be complications.
Yeah. Well, yes, and if it's me, there has to be a death.
Yeah.
but yes, I mean, and it's kind of exciting because it's very different.
Well, that's exciting. So how far are you? Or how long ago did you start this?
Well, I started about 3 months ago, but, you know, there have been all these readings and things for Stalker's Kitchen.
Sure.
So it's been very sporadic.
Yeah, so it's early days.
I've written about 40 pages, but they're extremely rough. We're still at the throwing paint at the wall stage.
Okay, great. So I just have a couple last questions for you, Juliet. I wonder if, now I said that there was a lot of exploration of appetite in this book, and so, you know, one of those appetites is sexual, and I wondered if we can talk a little bit, if you have advice for writers who maybe are attempting to write about sex for the first time, and you know, it can be kind of intimidating, and I thought you did it very well, and it's one of the things that's explored here, so can you talk a little bit about that?
I think if you're new to this, I mean, it is like writing about food in the sense that you have to move into metaphor,
right?
Don't you? I mean, you can't just try and throw adjectives and describe it. It's really how you feel and how you think the other person is feeling, and that the way you make love in a novel fits with who your character is. I mean,
yes.
Stalker is this greedy, grabby little soul.
Yeah.
And Angela is this sort of hard, closed-in soul. So you can imagine he's going to try and... Everything I say sounds dirty, but I'm going to say he's going to try and pry her open.
Yeah, yeah.
Metaphorically.
Right, right. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, when John... I mean, John is a sophisticate.
Right.
So you have to think about your character isn't necessarily you. So, and I think that would help, because I think it's a little strange and embarrassing to write about sex. But if you're writing and you say, yes, but this is Fred, this is not me.
Right.
How would Fred approach this? I think that's probably, I think it's very dangerous territory. I mean, every year, don't they have some kind of contest for the worst?
How mortifying, right?
Yes. And sometimes they're very famous authors are caught in that trap.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's wonderful advice, to consider who your character is. Every seduction is not going to look the same, and every seduction is not going to reflect, you know, the author's experiences or what he or she read last mm-hmm. week in somebody else's book. It's got to be specifically about your character or character.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Wonderful. So the very last thing I wanted to ask you is, and you use prompts and exercises, and you love the Ursula Le Guin exercises. So do you have perhaps a writing prompt that you would recommend to listeners who are writers, just for something to get them started in the coming week?
Well, this is one I like. If you have a character in mind you want to develop, but you don't really know him or her very well, say it's Joe. Just start writing a series of sentences. Joe likes pineapples. Joe is very tall. Joe almost looks as if he's dancing when he's walking down the street. Joe once had a girlfriend, but it was a very bad experience. And all of a sudden you find, he once had a girlfriend. Why was it? And you start moving into longer sentences. But anytime you get stuck, just go back to Joe is or Joe likes or Joe wants.
Wonderful. Yeah.
And you'll throw half of it away, but you'll find something in there, perhaps.
That is fantastic. I love it.
Okay.
Well, so we've been talking with Juliet Whitman. Her book is Stalker's Kitchen, published by Beck and Branch. I just wonder, Juliet, do you want to share your website with people where they can go to learn more if they would like to?
That's still a nub.
Oh, okay.
Juliet Whitman will do it, but my Facebook page is also Juliet Whitman.
Okay, that's a better spot for now. Okay, wonderful.
Yeah.
Juliet, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, you're listening to 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Have a great week.